Did I tell you, you saw that I'd got your album?
Yeah.
I really like it.
That makes me really cringe.
Hello, 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 hello. Hello, 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 hello. Welcome to episode 36 of the Word Monkeys podcast. My name is Matt Brown. I am a writer of children's fiction. My book series about a boy who accidentally creates a time machine are called Compton Valance. And you can, you know, check them out wherever you want to. Thank you very much for downloading. If you wouldn't mind popping a five-star rating wherever you get your podcasts from, it would help enormously spread the word about the Word Monkeys. Also, if you subscribe, that would be helpful as well. Today's Word Monkeys takes a little bit of a detour from the usual chat that I have on the podcast. So far, I have tended to gravitate towards authors of children and YA fiction. But today, I am chatting to Liz Horseman, who is not an author of children's fiction at all. In fact, she is a songwriter and former artiste in her own right. In 1999, she signed a record deal and released an album called Heavy High. In 2002, she released a follow-up album called Roaming. Since then, she has focused on producing and writing songs for loads of different people, including, perhaps most famously, Gabrielle Aplin. Just after Christmas 2017, I went to a party at a friend of mine's house who lives not far away, a couple of villages away from where I live. And I chatted for a very long time to Liz, who was there, and I'd never met her before. And we chatted a lot about writing and songs we liked and books we liked and that sort of thing. So I thought it would be fun if I could sort of recreate the chat. So I took my little recording bag and hightailed it down to her house, where she and her husband Mike have the most beautiful recording studio. And Liz has the most incredible workspace. It just looks out over beautiful fields and trees and woodland. It really is a really lovely place to sit and create and work. And Liz and I talked about all sorts of things in our chat. We talked about how she became a recording artist. We talked about coping with rejection when you are a creative person. We spoke about how she now writes music and songs, what's her process, and about some stuff that she's got in the pipeline. I had a lovely time around at Liz's house a couple of weeks ago. So let's just cut the waffle and crack on, shall we? All right.
I moved to London when I was 19, worked for a film company, actually.
Where did you move from?
From Ipswich. Yeah, from the middle of Ipswich, yeah.
Does Ipswich have any famous singers?
Yes, it does. It has. Well, I don't know if it's from Ipswich or Colchester. I think Colchester and Ipswich both claim him. But Nick Kershaw.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And yeah, I can't remember who else is from Ipswich. There are a couple of other people. But yeah, so I moved from Ipswich and yeah, got a record deal when I was 22. And I got signed by Andy Ross, who had also signed Blur. And that was the reason I signed with Andy, which is Food Records. But at that time, that record company had been taken over by Parlophone, which was part of EMI. And it became a very different thing. I thought I was signing to a little cool indie label in Camden. Mm. Actually, it was this massive, big corporation. And it just wasn't right for me at all. I wasn't really ready for that kind of world. I really should have just been strumming my guitar and doing little gigs and just writing songs, probably for other people, which is what I now do. Mm. And what they wanted me to do was to be the next big thing, the next Natalie Imbruglia, who was the big thing at that time.
Yeah.
And Simon Mayo played my first single, made it his record of the week on The Breakfast Show.
What was that, Heavy High?
Heavy High.
Yeah.
And so they released that one single. He made it record of the week, but Radio 1 didn't playlist it at all.
Right.
It was just like a 1 week thing. And then they basically dropped me.
The record label dropped
me. Yeah. Which wouldn't happen now. Now record labels, I mean, it's up and down. Like at the moment, I think record labels are really sticking with artists over a longer period of time because they understand how long it takes to get somewhere. Mm. Whereas I was signed and dropped really quite quickly, like made the album, one single, and then that was it. Didn't even release a second single.
Yeah.
So that's pretty unusual for these days. But I look back on it and think, I'm just really relieved. I mean, I think they just spent so much money. They were like, you know, that's fine. So, so I look back on it now and just think I'm very relieved that happened because I hated touring. I hated doing radio tours. Hated doing interviews.
Yeah, good. This is just a chat.
Yeah. I hated all of that stuff. I just wanted to be in the studio.
Yeah.
And that's obviously what I do now.
But then how long was the whole... So you record an album.
Yeah.
Your single of the week on Simon Mayo. Mm. Then you're dropped. How long was that period? How long were you like a recording artist for?
I think it was something like a year.
Right, okay.
I think I was signed and dropped within 18 months.
Okay.
Which is very short.
Yeah.
And it was very affecting in my life. I mean, I really struggled with that big time. And I really spiraled into a very negative place and took many years to pick myself up from that. I recorded a second album, which I put out myself.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which is something I felt much more proud of than the first album because I felt it was more me. Mm. I can't see my reflection in the waters. I can't speak the sounds to show no pain. I can't hear the echo of my footsteps or remember the sound of my own name. I mean, I wrote a song. Yes, and the lyrics on it were sort of like about how I'd almost lost myself and stuff. I think it was a really cathartic thing, and that is how it felt. It felt like I was just completely lost myself in this maelstrom of disappointment and rejection. But in that process, I learned how to produce music and how to record properly and all of those things. I learned Pro Tools, I taught myself. You know, all these things come good in the end, don't they? But at the time, it felt like the end of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I really feel for any artist who gets dropped, I know how painful that is. I'm working with another artist who was also dropped a year ago, and I see her, she's going through the same thing, and I know how it is, and I've been there. And I, no matter how many times you're told it's not you, it's them, this is a corporate commercial place and they have to make these business decisions, it doesn't make any difference, you just ultimately I'm not good enough. That's how it feels. So it's a dark place.
But I mean, really, do you think that it's like that, an artist, if they're dropped, is not good enough? I mean, I just have a slight parallel with the stuff that I do. A lot of me thinks that a hit in terms of a book will happen through a lot of luck as well as a lot of hard work and sort of talent. That hard work and talent is important, but there is a big slice of luck involved with
very much so.
Whether or not. So what I mean is that if an artist is dropped, it's maybe not because they're not good enough. It might just be that timing was not right, yeah, or something like that.
That's it. I think that's what you kind of have to tell yourself anyway. Maybe that's what it is. But yeah, I mean, I look back and think that the timing was all wrong for me on so many levels. And for them, it you know, I think had it been a different time, maybe it would have worked out for me. Mm. And for other artists, I know so many artists who have been dropped that you think, actually, I mean, there are so many incredibly talented artists that Mike or I have worked with over the years who got dropped, who made brilliant albums, who did quite well and then got dropped. And you think, if they haven't managed to, you know, be given the, you know, the golden seal of approval from the head of the label, then what chance is there for anybody else? And then you look at the story and you think, actually, there were so many bad luck moments there that you know, some things like real kind of acts of God, like, you know, flights being cancelled, them not being able to make a TV appearance, you know. Yeah. And actually, some, you know, you look at other people who've had very lucky experiences of getting just the right interview at the right time, and it just was that thing that set it all off. And they'll tell it that, you know, you hear artists say that was the interview that changed it all, or that was the TV appearance that changed everything. And so if you don't have those moments, that luck, then yeah, it's so much about that.
Yeah.
There are a lot of very talented people out there who haven't had the luck.
Yeah. And I suppose as well, I was thinking as you're saying that, of I watched the George Michael documentary recently, and the whole business with him and Sony. And even though he had, you know, laid the golden egg, and he was saying that he made Listen Without Prejudice and then didn't want to market it at all, because he just wanted it to be, you know, he hated marketing and didn't want to push it, and just thought it will stand up as its own thing. Personally, I think it's his masterpiece.
It's
that
amazing
album. It's incredible.
I absolutely love that album.
But he said that then that was the whole rift then between him and Sony started because of that. So even though he was, you know, the most one of the two or three most successful artists on the planet, he was still had problems with it. It was still it's a hugely commercial proposition, and they get pissed off if you don't sort of toe the line, sort of thing.
And I think also, you know, it's that I think labels will put up with any kind of bad behaviour if you're doing well. You know, I remember Amy Winehouse speaking to people that, you know, she was working with in the corporate side of things, and they were saying, you know, it's really tough, but, you know, she's doing big numbers, you know. And there's a lot about the responsibility of labels and managers, etc., to look after these delicate souls who most, if not all, musicians and songwriters are pretty delicate souls at heart. And we've got a responsibility to look after them, and there isn't enough around that. And obviously George Michael was no exception. So it's a very demanding world. It's a really demanding job.
Yeah.
Isn't it, being an artist? You know, like you obviously have to do promo for books and things, don't you? And
that's... But I quite like doing that, because I just love, I'm just a show off, so.
I suppose that helps. Yeah. Well, I think most artists are. I wasn't. I hated it. I hated that whole side of it. So I just, you know, it wasn't for me at all. But yeah, I think you have to be. You have to want to be at the front.
Yeah.
And you've got to be really savvy these days. Artists have got to have amazing Twitter presence. They've got to be funny and erudite and interesting and or gorgeous or whatever. That's why I'm just really pleased to hide in the studio.
Yeah. Ah, hello. This is Matt again. I just thought it'd be a good opportunity to let you know, as my past self and Liz are talking about tweeting, you can tweet me if you want to. My Twitter handle is @MattBrownAuthor. Okay, so if you've got any comments or questions, then, you know, get in touch. Okay, back to the chat. So when you were a recording artist, and then you put your your second album out yourself, and were you writing for other people as well then? How did you make the transition into becoming a sort of like a professional songwriter, I suppose?
Well, I think what happened was I ended up doing studio work as opposed to songwriting work. So Mike, my husband, Mike Spencer, who's a producer, he and I worked together really early. Well, we worked together on my first album. That's how we met. I've been assisting and programming for Mike for quite a long time. So I've been working on big pop records with him for ages. And that's massively helped my skill. You know, I've developed under Mike's, whatever guidance. Everything I know is what Mike's taught me, really. So that's made me a good technician. Mm. And from that, I was able to record the songs that I was writing. And I think that's a really crucial part of being a songwriter these days. You can't just play it badly onto a, dictaphone and send it to a record company and they go, hey, I think we've just got, Harry Styles' next hit. Mm. That's a fantasy. You've got to produce what sounds like a hit pop record. Finished.
Right, okay.
And that's got to be then listened to by the right people who think it's pretty much there.
Yeah.
And that's where you're at. So if you can't do that, you can't compete in as a songwriter.
Yeah.
It's got to be done.
Yeah.
You're handing over their next hit record.
Okay.
It's not just a song. It's got to sound exactly like they need it to sound. It's got to sound a lot like all of the other hit records that have existed in the last 18 months. With a slight freshness to it, but most importantly, it's got to feel like it's pretty much done.
Yeah.
So you can't just be a songwriter. You've got to be a producer now as well, and that's really changed. I would say, about 10 years ago, I think it was less like that. Now there's this, over the last probably 5 years, there's no chance of being a successful songwriter if you can't produce or unless you employ someone who produces for you, which some songwriters do. If you've had a few hits, then you can pay someone, can't you, to come into your studio every day and they can be your producer.
So when you're writing and we're in your writing room now and you're sat by your desk, you have got a keyboard on your desk.
Yes.
And a couple of computers.
The only reason I've got the keyboard on the desk is because I've let my 12-year-old son have the keyboard stand.
So that's usually
rather than
not on
him
desk.
Buying one, I've given him mine, so that wouldn't normally be there.
Okay, so you've got that. You've got a computer, and you've got a mic stand to the side of.
Yeah.
So you come in the morning with your chamomile tea.
Yeah, with my coffee first.
Your coffee.
Yeah. Yeah, so I come in. I come in and I turn on the computer.
Yeah,
and I work with I've worked with a little bit over the years a guy called Matt Johnson from The.
Mm-hmm.
And I love his phrase, which was the expectant hum of the machines. Or of the computer. It was the expectant hum. I love that because that is what it is. Like you turn it on and it kind of always into life. And it's almost like rubbing its hands together, going, okay, what are we going to do today? And that's your starting point. Mm-hmm. And I love that. So I turn on Pro Tools, which is the software that I use and have always used. And I just start working. I love my computer. I love working in the software. I said to Mike, if I could crawl inside it and live in it, I would. I just love it. I love it way more than I love sitting at a piano.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. I love writing like that. And I think that's probably why I've ended up doing what I've done for so many years now, doing engineering and programming, because I actually love that more than I love writing lyrics.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I that is the thing that I go to. So yeah. I love coming up with beats and chords and synth lines and stuff.
And is that how it begins? Way. It starts with those things rather than phrases or words?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes I will come up with a phrase and from that think, that's a great starting point. That's I came up with a... I wrote a song with an artist called Phono, which was called Real Joy, which I ended up singing, but only because everyone liked my vocal on it, not because it was the intention for me to sing it. My intention was for someone else to sing it. It's a big dance record, and the main phrase in that is, it's just an imitation of joy. It's just an
imitation. Right, okay.
Which is quite a weird phrase for a dance record, but I was watching TV one night watching Big Brother or something like that, and I just, it just popped into my head going, this is just an imitation of joy. We're so used to seeing everyone pretending, oh, we're all so happy, everything's amazing, we're it's such a laugh, oh my God, that's hilarious. And I was thinking, I'm so sick and tired of watching imitations of joy.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a cool phrase. Yeah. I don't think I'll ever squeeze that into a song, but I wrote it down. Mm. And then he sent me this backing track and it really works over it.
Yeah.
And I remember Zane Lowe saying, imitation of joy, where did that come from? That's just amazing. Mm. It's not what you would hear in an everyday dance record. So sometimes those things really work out, but sometimes if you sit down and you go, I've got to think of something clever.
Yeah.
That for me is death. I can't.
Yeah.
That's too much pressure.
So how does it work? Almost all of the stuff I write on spec. I write it and then try and sell it afterwards. Is that the same for you? Or do you get calls from people saying, we've got this new artist, or we're really looking for a song that is this, or here's a beat, or something like that.
Well, both. I mean, I work with, you see, I'm not what Mike and I would term as like roster songwriter, which is the kind of songwriter who is signed to a publishing company and is just sent artist after artist after artist. Mm. I don't want to do that. That's just not what I do, because I can't do that. I'm not good enough to do that. I love making records as well, and I love that variety. So if I just had to write songs day after day, I think I'd go crazy.
Yeah.
I love to work on records and just concentrate on the beat, or just concentrate on recording the vocals. So that's a real kind of conveyor belt, and there's nothing wrong with that. I have massive respect for those writers because they're very talented. That's not me. I don't work like that. I can come up with a great idea every now and again, and the rest of the time I want to be doing other things. I want to be writing and writing things for picture and things like that, doing other types of music,
okay,
or working on records with Mike, or developing artists in other ways, helping them with their live setup and being involved in that. I absolutely love just writing music without any goal. Mm. So like you were saying, you know, you're writing speculatively, you know, so you're sitting down with a blank piece of paper and saying what will come.
Mm.
And I love doing that without it being for anything. So, you know, just what will come. And over the last sort of 3 months, what's been coming out has been really symphonic pieces that don't last 3.5 minutes, that don't really have a bridge and a chorus and a verse, that sort of go on a journey themselves. And so I've been thinking, what do I do with this? And actually the only place that it could end up is on films and commercials, that kind of thing.
Mm.
So my publisher has been asking me to do some sort of speculative things like that to sort of see how that goes, and I'm really enjoying it, so we'll see where it takes me.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of not having those boundaries that you have with pop.
Yeah. Hi there, Matt again. No, not that Matt. Well, yes, that Matt. Just after this little bit of chat, Liz wanted to tell me a story about somebody that she'd worked with, somebody quite famous, and she asked me to turn off the tape recorder. Because she didn't want the story to be broadcast, which is completely fair enough. It was quite the story, and I certainly won't be looking at that particular celebrity again in quite the same way. But when I turned my recorder back on after she'd finished that story, she told another story which she felt could be included, as she didn't mention the name of the person involved. So this is what happened when I turned my recording device back on. Yeah, go on, what were you going to say?
So I was sent a girl band up, who I won't name, and I'd written a riff, and basically it could either be played major or minor. So I was like, it was in A, I was like, okay, so we could do this A major, and I played it the chord progression like this. I said, or you could have it like this, A minor. Mm. And so played it. And she stood up and walked across the room in a right strop. And she went, right, well, I don't even know what major or minor is. So I don't know why you're trying to confuse me with all these words. And I was like, oh, I don't mean to do that. I just, fine, let's sit back down. What I mean is, do you want it? And I started going, happy
or sad?
Or sad. And yeah, it didn't go well. She came in with a like, real attitude of just like, you know, just you're just trying to make me feel small. And of course I wasn't. Ooh. I just, and that kind of thing, it just sort of, that end of pop music, I just, for me, I find that really draining. Mm. I don't find that soul enhancing. I find it soul destroying. And at the end of it, I think, well, she didn't feel good about herself at the end of that. And I don't feel good about myself at the end of that. So, you know, whereas some people can do that all day, every day, and they can be dispassionate. And they can say, it's a job. Get over yourself. It's a job.
Yeah.
And I respect that. It's just that isn't something that I can do. And I want more from music than that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So that's why I love working with people like Gabrielle Aplin, who is, she's just a lovely soul. She's a very honest artist who writes songs that are from her heart, and we can write songs together that we both, I just love the process. Mm. And we click so well. We write songs that just, we write so easily, you know. And if you find those relationships, you think, that's what I want to do, and it just feels right to have that.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think that's a really nice place to end it.
Good, excellent.
That feels like a positive, got a bit of an anonymous slagging off. a nice, positive, upbeat end.
Excellent.
And there we have it. Episode 36 of The Word Monkeys, done and almost dusted. I would like to say a huge thank you to Liz and to Mike Spencer, her husband, who just couldn't be lovelier people, and were really welcoming when I came and showed me around their studio and listened to my stupid opinions about music and all of that sort of stuff. So thank you very much to those two. I hope you enjoyed it. There will be more from the Word Monkeys very soon indeed. Please rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. Have a great day/week/month/year until we speak again. Goodbye.